Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. It is still Trump's America, 5 weeks and counting, and a lot going on in the news this week. A new report reveals a shocking lack of racial diversity among top Senate staff. We'll be digging into that with some former Senate staffers who themselves are people of color who now work at the Center for American Progress and have perspectives to share on that. And what is the role of media in the age of Trump? But first, in case you missed it, Jeremy Slevin is tragically and heartbreakingly away at a conference, and so Brandon Tensley is here to replace him yet again. Brandon, welcome back to the show.
I feel it's good to be, you know, finally be back on and replace Jeremy.
Your second debut, which is not a thing because debut only happens once. But that being said, you are back.
But for me, it can be my second debut. That's fine. We break rules here.
Debut number two, if you will. Also with me in studio is Greg Kaufman, the one, the only, the editor-in-chief of TalkPoverty.org. Greg, it's been too long.
It has been too long. I've been waiting for an invitation back. So thank you, Rebecca, for finally extending it. And what a treat to be in studio with Brandon as well.
Were you starting to wonder if we liked you on the show?
I wasn't wondering. I had reached certain conclusions.
Well, those conclusions are unfounded. You're back because we love you. You have important things to share, particularly this week because of some cool stuff going on at TalkPoverty.org. But first, Brandon, what's going on in the news this week that we should care about?
Well, the first and probably most political thing happening right now is Trump has selected his energy secretary, his nominee for that.
The nomination picks keep coming. The hits keep on coming. Who did he pick?
Dun, 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 dun. Can we get a drum roll? He picked ex-governor of Texas, Rick Perry.
Rick Perry.
Is that ironic for anyone?
Stop me if I'm remembering incorrectly, no pun intended, but wasn't he the guy who forgot the Department of Energy when he was trying to list agencies that he would eliminate?
That indeed was him in 2011 during a Republican debate. And he was like, oops.
Oops. It was the oops moment.
That all sounds right to me, but I can't quite remember.
Or there was a third thing that
there
you were...
There was something else.
About him that made him qualified.
Yeah. Oh, the glasses. He has glasses.
That's true.
So, you know, there's that.
That was what made him okay for this
exactly.
Choice, right? And it was, he didn't know about the agency. Oh, but he's got the glasses now.
But kidding aside, this is one of the agencies he wanted to eliminate, correct?
If he could remember it.
So... Yikes.
But now he's going to run it, so that will be interesting to watch. But hey, you know, Trump keeps picking people who are not just unqualified, but actually deeply offensive for these roles. So hard to leave that one out of the news roundup. What else is going on in the world this week, Jeremy? I just called you Jeremy, Brandon. Do you see how reflexive that is?
I think Jeremy would be proud to know that.
Would you be?
Like, he's not actually replaceable. He's like, I told you guys.
It would be horrible and offensive if I just called you Jeremy while you're playing the Jeremy role, right? I can't do that.
Yeah.
Even for my own convenience. Brandon, what else is going on in the news this week?
So on Tuesday, Governor Kasich vetoed the quote-unquote heartbeat bill.
Republican governor of Ohio.
Mm-hmm. But he signed into law a bill that would ban abortion 20 weeks after fertilization. And so now, I mean, it's horrible, right? So it's replacing one bad thing, thinking that you're doing something good. But the new law doesn't make any exceptions for rape or incest. And it's part of a sort of dangerous effort to roll back abortion rights. It's a huge deal and it's frightening.
You led with the bill that he vetoed, which was unbelievably objectionable and reactionary. It would ban abortion once a doctor is able to detect a fetal heartbeat long before viability or you know, what is actually allowable under Roe versus Wade at this point. But the bill that he then signed into law, by contrast, seems less crazy, right? Because it's the less bad version and yet dramatically weakens access to reproductive justice. Do you have any good news for us?
I do.
She said, hopefully.
So coming out of Missouri. So in Missouri, actually our friends at Think Progress reported that the state was diverting $4.3 million of TANF funds, so temporary 1880 families, to promote alternatives to abortion. So these crisis pregnancy centers. which in these organizations, as they say in the report, that they are designed to discourage women from getting abortions, and they often do this by misleading or just straight up lying.
So that's not the good news, I hope.
Nope. Good news.
Because that doesn't sound like good news to me.
The good news is that a Missouri legislator actually wants to send these TANF funds to hungry families instead of these crisis pregnancy centers.
Oh, so maybe using the money for its intended purpose as opposed to diverting it to whack science that is deceitfully trying to prevent women from exercising their right to choose.
Mm-hmm.
Novel thought. Well, if that's what passes for good news these days.
Yikes.
I feel like we have to take what we can get in these dark days.
I guess that's probably right. Now, of course, Missouri not really in a camp of its own, given that basically 1 in 4 TANF dollars nationally actually go to helping struggling families with kids. The rest gets diverted. But this is a particularly interesting and questionable purpose that level of annual TANF funding is getting diverted to go to.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to figure out if I can come up with any fake news for that one.
That's great. This segment will become a fake news segment. Outstanding.
Nope. Got nothing for
good.
That.
Thank you for that. Let's make that what we do here, not come up with fake news for our weekly radio show. Thanks, Greg, if you want to get invited back.
Yes.
Anything else, Brandon?
I think those were the highlights for This Week in Poverty. Leaving time for Greg to tell us something more positive as we look forward.
Well, and so a big thing that folks may have noticed is happening is that the Obama administration is very, very, very sadly coming to an end. A lot of people are reflecting on what his legacy is and starting to write those stories and share those perspectives about what he's accomplished, what he has meant. Some of it's about policy. Some of it's more about symbolism, the fact of the first black president. And Greg, this is part of what you're actually exploring over at talkpoverty.org.
Yeah. And obviously, the closer we get to Inauguration Day, the better and better Obama's legacy is looking, I think most of us would agree. But we'll have over the next 2 weeks about 15 pieces, 15 contributors writing about various aspects of Obama's legacy, as well as the stakes under a Trump administration. And also, I think on a lot of people's minds are, you know, how we protect some of the gains we've made. So we kicked off the series this week. We've had posts from by the way, we're co-sponsoring the series with the Georgetown Center on Poverty and Inequality.
A nice plug for our dear colleagues,
yeah.
Peter Edelman, who runs that shop.
Who wrote this week about President Obama's approach to place-based poverty. Promise zones. We've done a lot of work on promise zones here at CAP as well.
And on the show, definitely something we've talked about extensively.
Which is steering resources to communities and to local leaders who know how to address the problems in communities. And presumably that's something that conservatives could get behind too, but we'll see. If that's just rhetoric or reality. We've had our former colleague Anna Chu, who's over at the National Women's Law Center, wrote this week about Obama's record on women's equality. And we have a lot of other exciting pieces come up. I don't want to tell about all the authors. Let it be a bit of a surprise. But I think right now, as most people reflect on the 8 years, especially given where we started, which we all have to remember was the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression and could have easily been a depression, the man's accomplished a lot. And with Republicans in opposition since 2010, making it harder and harder for him to do some very basic things. So
I don't want to make you give away any big spoilers, but you do have some pretty exciting folks contributing to this series. So I'll put in my shameless plug that listeners should go check out talkpoverty.org and reflect themselves on some of the legacy from the last 8 years and where we go from here. And as you said, what's at stake. And I will also, in case he's listening, put out a call to Ta-Nehisi Coates in case he would like to come on the show and discuss his phenomenal, amazing, must-read, long-read about the first black president and what that is causing him to think about in terms of where we've been and where we go as a country.
That would be fantastic to get him on the show.
Mr. Coates, if you're listening.
And I will say my former employer, The Nation magazine, just put – their issue on Obama's legacy online, and you've had reporters such as Ari Berman on your show.
And Katrina Vandenhoevel, who's the editor there.
Yeah, so I'm sure they have a lot of good pieces. It's a really good time to take stock of sort of where we've been and where we're going and what we need to do next.
Particularly as the world starts to burn around us.
There's that.
And on that note, we will transition into a conversation that does not involve Greg, sadly.
Sorry about that.
No, I know you're sorry.
I would like to be a part of it. I stay?
No, you can't. You can't stay. You can't stay because you are not a former Senate staffer. But
that's
next
true.
Up,
there's that.
Next up, the amazing and horrible and awful and shameful lack of racial diversity among Senate staff. Stay tuned.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. You wouldn't know how diverse the United States is from looking at our government. But it doesn't just come down to members of Congress. It's a huge issue when it comes to their staff. Take the Senate. Of the 100 senators in the current session, only one, South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, who is black himself, has an African-American chief of staff. The overwhelming whiteness that we're seeing in our country's halls of power doesn't bode well for ensuring that the interests of all Americans are factored into key policy decisions. Here to talk about the lack of diversity among Senate staff are Michelle Jawando, she's the Vice President of Legal Progress here at the Center for American Progress, and Pat Collier, he's the Director of Government Affairs here at CAP, both themselves former Hill staffers on the Senate side. Guys, thanks for joining the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Well, I've had Michelle on before.
Yes.
Pat, I've been wanting to get you on for a while, so
yes.
It's happening. The day has arrived, but I want to get right down to it. So help me understand, there's a new report out that actually really shines a light on this issue, on the lack of diversity. Michelle, break down that report to kick us off. What are the numbers here in terms of lack of diversity among Senate staff?
So the one of our partners that we work often with and former Hill staffer himself, at the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, did almost a year-long survey, I believe, where they were following up with every office on the Senate. And this is one of the problems, right? There is no public repository of this information. So you are following up with Senate offices. And most people, when you think about the Senate, there are three positions that are typically considered the senior staff. It is the chief of staff. It is the legislative director who handles and really gives the overview of what policies that particular senator will move forward on. So that's what the legislative director's role is. And then the communications director, right? So who moves the process forward? Now, you will often find that there are other kind of leadership roles. So there are a lot of chief counsels and senior counsels. You'll find senior advisors. But the traditional roles that are considered the senior staff or chief of staff, legislative director, and communications director. And the Joint Center did a report and basically found that of the 100 senators and looked at Republicans and Democrats, that there was only one African-American chief of staff in the Senate. That is someone who is the chief of staff to Senator Tim Scott from South Carolina. There were no African-American legislative directors and no African-American communications directors.
So one, if I'm counting correctly, mm-hmm. out of 300 of these people, right? Because you named three key positions in 100 offices.
That's right.
So one third of a percentage point of these senior staff in the Senate are black.
That's right. And the reason why, and I love the way that you just classified it, is it's so troubling because many of the Senate offices where you would expect there to be representation based on the demographics of that state were not represented. You know, so in many of these states, African Americans or people of color have a larger larger share of the population, and you would think that the staff would be representative, but that wasn't something that was evidenced in this report.
So some of the, just to put numbers to this, mm-hmm. some of the states that this report dug into in particular were because of the reasons you mm-hmm. just mentioned, such as Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Maryland, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, Virginia, Delaware, and Mississippi and Maryland. Those 10 states,
that's right.
African Americans represent almost 40% of the population in those 10 states,
that's right.
but only 1.7% of top Senate staff
that's
positions.
Right.
So a huge gulf.
A huge disparity. And if you consider also, if you kind of split that out, so we mentioned earlier, the only senior person in staff was on the Republican side, who now Tim Scott is an African-American senator from South Carolina. But if you look at Democrats, who typically have a party of inclusiveness and they talk about diversity as a central theme of the Democratic Party, to not have that reflected in senior leadership is something that, you know, many would say is quite troubling.
And not walking the walk. So, mm-hmm. Pat, turning over to you. So you guys were both former Senate staffers, as I mentioned. And as I learned, as we were queuing up the mics, you were also both former House side staffers mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. So I want to sort of take this out of the abstract and the theoretical and the numbers. And I want to bring in some of your personal experience here. So as a former Senate staffer yourself and a person of color, and I should have said you guys are both African-American.
Right.
Why does it matter? Why does it make a difference whether or not we have top Senate staff who are people of color?
Because personnel is policy. So to the extent that the folks in the room are crafting the legislation or working on the policy, that will affect all Americans. You need that diversity of thought and you need contributions from everyone in order to make sure you're getting the best piece of legislation. Case in point, the Clean Power Plan was just a huge victory for this administration. There's frustration in some of the environmental justice community around it because of the way it was written. The plan could result in pockets of pollution that would affect black and brown communities. And because those groups did not have a seat at the table, and because, and I think you can make the case that because the absence of leadership, the absence of people of color at those senior ranks, you know, that insight that's not brought to bear at the outset, you know, before you even craft the legislation.
So, and Michelle, I want to give you the same opportunity to comment as a former Senate staffer yourself. So do you have any specific experiences you remember where you found yourself to be the only person of color in the room, and there was a reason that made a difference for your job and for the jobs that other people were doing?
So, you know, at one point in the Senate, particularly, and this became pretty stark when the Obama administration happened. And the numbers even kind of decreased in other roles. So you think about legislative assistants, those who are working on legislation, or legislative correspondents who help in responding to the constituents' needs.
And those are both more junior roles.
Those are
lots
both more
of those
right.
in the halls
there's,
of the Senate.
There's a lot more. And so you will see a little more diversity, little, because we knew everybody, right? we could all fit in one really big room. Not that big of a room, actually. But what ended up happening is a number of people saw that there was a ceiling in the Senate, and they left and went to the administration. Mm. And you saw a number of people who were able to move into kind of mid management or senior roles in the administration. There were opportunities that were much more fruitful if they left the Senate. Many didn't want to, but that they saw that as an opportunity for growth, because in some ways they saw that there was a ceiling in the Senate.
And I think it impacts you professionally when you don't have those avenues, when you don't have a lane for advancement, when there's a ceiling there at the senior level, it affects your job opportunities post-Hill career, right? So there are a lot of opportunities off the Hill a number of organizations that work in and around the spaces that we work in, and they're looking for former Hill staffers who have had senior positions or have held senior positions to run their organization or to manage the portfolio of issues that they care about. And absent that title, absent that opportunity, those future opportunities are foreclosed. Right? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. you have this kind of what Michelle alluded to, you have this glass ceiling. And so typically you see African Americans staffers leave the Hill after, you know, reaching the LA level, maybe policy advisor level, just because those opportunities for senior roles are just not there.
Michelle. And one, you know, just to be responsive to your question, one of the one of the incidents that I remember so starkly was the issue around stop and frisk.
Yeah.
And both the language that we were using in the Senate, and not really being able to understand the impact of what that meant. And so I remember being the only person of color in a meeting with some of my other counsels who were representing their senators.
Because that was the position you held on the Hill. You were a counsel,
right,
as
so
a lawyer.
I served as a general counsel and senior advisor and was a part of the leadership team in my Senate office. And I appreciated it and was such an opportunity for my own personal professional growth and development. And there were access points that I had that I know many of my colleagues did not. And so I always recognized that I was definitely in a privileged position. But I remember going to this meeting with other counsels, and someone said, I won't share what state they were from, and this is another staffer, young white guy, maybe early 30s, and he said, I don't get what the big deal is.
With stop
and frisk.
Because
if you're not doing anything wrong, then you don't have anything to be afraid of. And I remember, you know, most of the time you're social, you're cordial, because you're working late hours, long hours with your colleagues, you're working on different pieces of legislation. But that moment, I said, you must not understand what it's like to come home, be a block from your house, and someone pulls you to the side, because it's happened to me, it's happened to my father, it's happened to my brother, and you don't understand the lack of the loss of dignity mm-hmm. that you feel, because just how you look, someone thinks that you've done something wrong. And that's why it's a big deal. And I remember the whole room went really quiet. And that's the challenge when you're doing policymaking, because if you don't understand the impact of what policy does to real people, and the harms that can potentially be caused or prevented, then you're missing the full story.
Yeah. Similarly, during the ACA ramp up around the ACA, there's a member who sat on a help committee who's policy director at the time.
And that's a committee that has jurisdiction over health, education, labor, and pensions in the Senate.
Yes. That member had a policy director who was African-American woman, and she worked very hard to get language added to the ACA that dealt with the health disparities mm-hmm. in the African-American community and communities of color. But that's only because she had a seat at the table mm-hmm. and understood how the process worked, but also could make the argument for why that was good policy mm-hmm. in general, not mm-hmm. just for communities of color, but understanding that when you protect the least of us, you drive down the overall cost of health care, and that actually was a benefit for ACA overall. And it's that type of insight, that type of perspective that's missing when you don't have representation at the senior ranks.
I'm speaking with Pat Collier and Michelle Jawando. They're both former Hill staffers, including on the Senate side, who themselves are people of color and are in the minority when it comes to folks who look like they do in senior positions in Senate staff, as a new report finds. You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. So I want to inject one piece into this conversation, which doesn't have to do with race, but the first thing I thought when I saw the stark findings out of this report was, holy shit, right? That was the first thing. The second thing I thought, right, was shame on us, because this applied, as you, Michelle pointed out, not just to Republicans, but also to Democrats. Mm-hmm. And so we're clearly not walking the walk. But the third thing I thought was, man, this isn't just about race. This is about different perspectives on a whole slew of different mm-hmm. things. So whether you're a person with a disability, mm-hmm. whether you're a person who is LGBT, whether you're a man, whether you're a woman, and so forth. And so it feels like this is breaking open a whole conversation that has maybe happened not enough, but to some extent about members of Congress themselves, but not at all about the people who really have so much more power than is visible in policymaking.
Well, you know, the thing about the Hill, as is, you know, the affectionate name for those who work on the House or the Senate or in the Capitol, is there are a million pieces of legislation coming to you every single day. You're meeting with hundreds of people, special interest groups, lobbyists, other members, other staffers. And so the role of a staffer is really important because you are the funnel. You are the one who decides, does this memo get in front of your boss? Who's the person who's going to sit down and have a conversation with the senator, or do you meet with the staffer? And being a part of the decision-making table to make the choices for that senator is huge. You know, I know that when people said, hey, Michelle, can you get this in front of your boss? It meant something for me to actually say, yes, I can. But there are very few people who had the ability and who currently have the ability to do that. And the numbers only seem to have gotten worse.
Mm-hmm. And I think that also kind of bodes for the impact or potential impact for stakeholder groups who do care about issues that affect communities of color, right? So absent individuals who have that level of access or who can get a memo in front of a member's off, you know, on a member's desk, then those groups and those issues that are unique to that constituent group, they're at a loss. They don't have an advocate. They don't have a real advocate. And that's part of what we're losing with this, the current kind of status quo, is that you have groups who are functionally kind of excluded from those debates and those discussions.
Now, this report that was released by the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, it spurred a letter that was sent to every Senate office by the Senate Black Legislative Staff Caucus. Mm-hmm. Now, that letter didn't just say this is a huge problem. It also laid out some calls to action. Mm-hmm. What were the suggestions that it made for how we can change this? And do you think that they go far enough?
And since Pat was a former president of the Senate Black Legislative Staffers, I'll let you kick that one off, Pat.
Thank you.
El Presidente, thoughts?
The three key recommendations that the letter makes. The first is the creation of a nonpartisan diversity office within the Senate. The second encourages that office and the members and the Senate to work with third-party organizations and government agencies to create senior-level fellowships and an intern pipeline for each office, and to really expand what really actually is a pretty robust pipeline that's already really in place. And the third and final recommendation is to increase the resources of the Office of Compliance to allow them to expand their training and education capacity to address these issues. So those are the three recommendations that grew out of that letter.
And, you know, I would say some of the recommendations that people have given in person have been as simple as just like a Rooney Rule kind of idea, right? So when you're having an interview for a position in your office, the same way the NFL has done a great job of increasing like the number of African-American coaches, successful coaches, you look at Mike Tomlin in Pittsburgh, maybe you should interview at least one person of color for these positions. And we often hear, oh, it's really hard to find resumes and get the pipeline. And we just know categorically that that's not true, that there's a wealth of people who are, you know, on K Street, and that's the kind of affectionate name for people who work typically in corporate or lobbying circles. There's a number of people on K Street, a number of people who are in nonprofits or think tanks who, if we're asked to serve, would do it and do it well.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about that pipeline issue in particular, right? Because it's not just about racial diversity where this conversation and that theme has come up, right? I'm reminded of the 2012 campaign and Mitt Romney and binders of women.
Binders full of women, right? I think everybody that year for Halloween went as a binder of women, myself included, right? Because it was the thing. But we laugh about it, and it's funny, and we should, because it was ridiculous what he said. But this is
something that gets said a lot, right? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm all for hiring diverse people in a whole slew of ways, but I just don't know where to find them. Is that an excuse or an explanation that holds any water at all, or is it maybe a little more complicated than that?
No, it definitely doesn't hold water. I mean, even the Center for American Progress, for example, they have a leadership institute where they each year they bring in a class of students and people of color to help them transition into policy jobs.
Creating the pipeline.
Exactly. And there are a number of programs. There's the CBCF, Congressional Black Caucus Foundation internship program.
Fellows program.
Mm-hmm. And each year they bring in classes anywhere of 20 to 40 college and graduate students to intern on the Hill and gain that policy experience. So the pipeline's there. Not to mention, and we kind of talked about this offline, but the Congressional Black Caucus actually does a good job of cultivating a lot of its talent. Most CBC offices have chiefs of staffs and communications directors and legislative directors of color. That's a pool there with relevant Hill experience that Senate offices could draw from as well. So that pipeline exists, and I think the recommendation for a nonpartisan diversity office in the Senate could be they could kind of own that process of gathering all of these pipelines, or at least be the conduit for all of those pipelines, and help push out talented folks to each of these offices.
And this goes back to Michelle's point from early on in the conversation we've been having about how these data aren't even currently collected. Right,
that's
this was an outside third party organization that had to ask the question and collect the data. Mm-hmm. So, do you believe that this is going to be maybe one of those cases of what gets counted is going to get done?
Well, I think that's like the power of organizations like the Center for American Progress, who track and do data and research, because if at least you can categorize what the problem is, if you can see the numbers in your face, then maybe that gives you some impetus to do something different. I also want to kind of circle back to something you said is this really a problem, and how do we find the pipeline? I think some of the stark differences that we see specifically at the senior level really speak to how we socialize and how segregated in some ways we are. Mm. Because we know that the capital of your social network is the most important, in some ways, asset that people have in Washington, D.C.
It's not about what you know, it's who you know.
Right. If you know someone who has been to your alma mater, or has kind of played in the same kind of sports that you play in, or, you see them at your kid's school, there are different kind of connections that you make, and inherently you see yourself in that person. You know, there's a whole trove of social science research that, if you're a right-handed person, and by instance, you happen to be interviewing someone who's right-handed, you're 10 times more likely to hire that person than if they were a lefty. Sorry,
they're
lefties.
Like you.
They're like you. And so, so when we see some of these stark differences, you have to wonder, part of this is connected to kind of implicitly how we see each other and the value that we place on different kind of experience and expertise. So maybe people aren't seeing House Chief of Staffs as someone who can make the transition to the Senate. But is that because of color? Is that because of background? They don't see themselves there. And so, as we continue to kind of push forward towards solutions, I also see it as a charge for us to think about our social networks and the way we value. Because if you could see a Black chief of staff, if you could see a Black legislative director, if you see a Black communications director, and once you get the first, it makes it easier for the second and the third, because you know it happens. And we have yet to see it. When Don Cravens, who was Senator... Landry's chief of staff from Louisiana, when he left, he was an elected official, Marine. I mean, he was everything, headed one of the committees. When he left the Senate, he said to all of his fellow chiefs of staff that I should not be the only one who, when I leave this room, be the only one who looks like me leaving this room. And till this day, on the Democratic side, that's still the case.
Yeah. To your point, or your question about data collection, I think it's absolutely essential. We know in this era of analytics that what we collect or what we designate for a collection, that's really a way of identifying what our priorities are, right? So Congress years ago saw fit to require certain employees to maintain records on demographics of their employees. Why shouldn't the Senate follow their own guidance?
So we've only got a few minutes left, and I feel like we could talk about this all day, clearly.
Sure,
I'd bring the wine in, and we'd be good all night, right? Because you know I've got it. But so you've brought up the House side being a little bit different than the Senate side. What is going on there that's different, and why is there a gap between what's happening in the House and what's happening in the Senate on this?
I think if you subtract it out, the offices of color in the Tri-Caucus, so Congressional Black Caucus, Congressional Hispanic Caucus, Asian Pacific Islander Caucus, you would have a dynamic
similar
to the Senate. So the House is doing better, but that's because they have more members of color.
Right. The Senate currently now, with the election of its third senator, who is African-American, now has three.
Right. Compared to, I believe,
47 members
something in the high 40s.
Congressional Black Caucus who are on the House side. So I think Pat is right. You know, when the Senate, which affectionately was sometimes called the last plantation, that was one of the nicknames. I wanted to share that with your listeners, because that's some of the perspective that some of the staffers who work there feel. And until we see this as something that we want to do a better job on, then we're not going to pay attention to it, and we're not going to think critically. And people don't want an opportunity just for the sake of it. People are good and are smart and are capable and can do the job. They just need the opportunity to do so. And I think this isn't about handouts, and this isn't about you just trying to do something so that the liberal media will stop talking about this issue.
I hope they'll start talking about it.
I know, because we need more voices like you talking about these issues. This is about how you make better policy for Americans. Yeah. And right now, there are voices that are missing at the table, and that harms us all.
So I want to ask one final question, which is, we've talked a lot about policymaking inside Congress as the reason we're having this conversation. And I think that's been how this report has been viewed, is it's about what happens there. But you guys are walking, living, breathing evidence that people don't get born and die as, right, Senate staffers, right? There's life after that. And you go on and you do other work. Are there spillover effects of this lack of diversity among particularly Senate senior staff into other important sectors?
Oh, certainly. I think I may have referenced that a little bit earlier, but, you know, typically what happens is that for organizations who work in and around Congress and who represent these issues that we all care about, they typically will hire staffers to run and manage those organizations because they're familiar with the rhythm of the Hill, and they have the relationships to get these issues in front of the right people. And generally for those leadership posts in those organizations, they like to hire former staffers who held leadership posts in those Senate offices, because you not only do you have that relationship with that member, mm-hmm. but you also have relationships with other LDs if you're an LD, mm-hmm. or other chiefs of staff if mm-hmm. you're a chief of staff. And that's the cachet that you bring with you. And so absent that opportunity, you're limiting those, absent the opportunity to be in leadership in a member office, don't have the opportunity to assume leadership posts outside or once you leave the Hill.
Michelle, you'll have the last word.
So I will just say this. This is a problem that has long been diagnosed. And I think, you know, we have a group of former Black Senate staffers who have been talking about this issue for some time. But I think with the absence of Barack Obama leaving the White House, you will soon be in a position where there isn't a visible senior African-American in any of the positions elected, and what the residual effect was having senior African-American people in the administration. And so now, with kind of the traditional institutions taking a major role, it's going to be even more important for Congress to step up and to think about, who do I need to help me govern in a climate where kind of racial tensions are as high as they have been in years, maybe since the 60s, to help me govern and help me come up with the policies and the solutions that will help me speak to all of the needs of the American people. And that's really where we are right now.
I've been speaking with Michelle Jawando. She leads the Legal Progress Program here at the Center for American Progress and is a former Senate staffer and House staffer, I have learned. And Pat Collier, the Director of Government Affairs here at CAP. Guys, thanks for taking the time to have this really important conversation.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. Since the election, the media has taken a thrashing for what many people have labeled its failure to take Trump to task when it mattered most on the campaign trail. But some argue we shouldn't let a crisis go to waste, and we need to do more than just beat up on journalism. Here to talk about where the media needs to go in the Trump era is Judd Legum. He's editor-in-chief and founder of Think Progress. Judd, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm just going to start with the million-dollar question. Did the media fail?
I think so. You know, I think the New York Times wrote the other day that they, along with other people in the media, became agents of Russian intelligence during the election. So I think if you become an agent of Russian intelligence and you have the self-awareness to say that, then I think that's pretty much a failure. And I think it speaks to sort of what happened is that we kind of lost all context. You know, there were bad stories about Trump. There were bad stories about Hillary. It all kind of became a cacophony of awfulness that soured many people on the election. But there wasn't a lot of perspective about where things were coming from and the seriousness of one story versus another.
Well, so help me understand then, if hindsight is always 20/20, and we get to, how many metaphors can I mix here? We get to Monday morning quarterback, what should have happened? What could and what should traditional media have done differently so that we didn't end up potentially with a president-elect Trump, or more broadly, so that we didn't feel that a failure on the part of media was part of what brought about that outcome?
I think there's a lot of components to it. One of the things that I think was particularly destructive this time around was the increasing emphasis on the horse race, particularly polling and kind of this new field of meta polling analysis, where everyone kind of disassociates themselves from what's actually happening, and it's all about sort of observing it from a 40,000-foot level, assigning a percentage chance that this candidate or that candidate will win, when the reality is no one knows until the election, and none of that that information doesn't inform anyone or really help anyone make a decision. It's just mostly entertainment. And so much of the coverage, there's obviously sites that just focus exclusively on that, but so much of the coverage is through that lens.
And as I hear you describe that type of coverage, I mean, you sort of can't have this conversation without naming Nate Silver, right, creator of 538, which in many cases is what people were going to and saying, this makes me feel like I think Hillary's going to win, or today I feel like Trump is going to win. Do you feel that it's the horse race coverage and the probability kind of stuff itself that is the problem, or is that a symptom of a larger problem?
It's probably a symptom somewhat. I mean, I think it's just – it's Nate Silver obviously was on the vanguard of this, but a lot of people have followed them. You know, the New York Times had a very similar site. Huffington Post has a very similar site. There's nothing really wrong with these sites. I mean, there's nothing really wrong with taking polls and seeing what's going on. But it's the emphasis that's my issue, and the fact that so much of it is geared towards that. And – what else could we be doing with our attention and the limited resources that the media has to focus on the real issues, to put some of these other stories like the hacking and the information that was coming out for WikiLeaks, to put it into some kind of context rather than just sort of reporting on it as gossip. And I think one of the things that Trump does very effectively is sort of exploit the weaknesses in the media, the sense that they always have to kind of go for the news story, the story that's going to drive ratings and clicks. He's very effective at that and was able to, despite a rash of negative stories about him, really remarkably negative stories about him, was kind of able to effectively counteract that and kind of turn the tide at the last minute with an assistance from Russia, with assistance from the FBI, with assistance from a lot of places, kind of drew it inside straight, but was able to get it done.
And I want to go in more to what Trump was able to do when it came to sort of exploiting the way that the media operates. But before losing the thread of kind of the post-mort, what happened, what was media's role, I do want to ask the question, because you run a news site, thinkprogress.org. Do you feel that you were complicit in the media's failure to do what it needed to do to talk about those real issues? Or do you feel that Think Progress did something differently than most other mainstream media?
I think we did some things well and some things probably not as well as we should have. I do think sort of institutionally we always stay away from the horse race coverage. You'll never see a story that's just about, you know, polling or who's ahead in a particular state. The one thing I think that we didn't do as well is try to focus back on issues and make them alive for people. The issue contrast in this election really got lost. And obviously we wrote about people's proposals and it wasn't like we ignored it, but I think we, along with a lot of other people, could have done more. And so if we reran this, I think I would go back and try to figure out how to animate the issues part more. I think it was more difficult covering this election than in any other election I've been involved in covering, because there was just so little discussion of it. But that's what I would have done differently, I think.
Well, so then taking that as a good segue into how Trump really masterfully exploited, it looks now in retrospect, the way that the media operates and really took it to his great advantage. In traditional elections, and what we've seen for a long time, is that television ad buys are really the biggest part of what a presidential candidate spends their money on when it comes to trying to communicate to people what they stand for, how it's better than what their opponent is selling. And we saw that with Hillary Clinton in this particular election. But that wasn't necessarily what Donald Trump did, and that wasn't his strategy. What did he do, and how did he play the way the media operates so effectively?
I think he did a lot of different things. He was able to reduce the friction to achieve earned media. So he pioneered the ability to call into television shows anytime he wanted to, and they put him on because he would say outrageous things or racist things or whatever he happened to want to say that day. He also with his Twitter account, found another way to generate news and headlines that just takes a few seconds. And you just sort of have to contrast that to the typical way that a politician does a media hit. You know, they book it, they think about where to go, they prepare, their staff will prepare a briefing book that will discuss which questions might be asked and give them all the facts behind it. And it's a major undertaking, which is why traditionally, especially a candidate running for president, would limit their appearances somewhat. Trump really didn't have any of those restrictions, clearly didn't spend much time preparing for any of these appearances. It was a which was sort of a feature because that would give him more things to say that would lead to more headlines and then get more earned media. But just to reduce that friction basically to almost nothing and be omnipresent throughout the campaign, I think was effective and kind of kept his supporters really engaged and enthused.
And his use of social media in particular, mm-hmm. and I would love to hear you go a little bit into how his campaign actually used social media over, say, televised ad buys as a strategy for communicating with the public.
Yeah. If you look at the numbers, you can look at the numbers over the last month of the campaign, but really throughout, Hillary Clinton had a big advantage financially, but if you break it down, and also a big advantage on television. But if you break it down and look at the last month, Trump almost had a 2-to-1 advantage, somewhere around 30 million, 29 million in spending online in the last month. Hillary was in like the $16 million range, and he was able to use it in a very targeted way, using Facebook mostly, in a very targeted way to motivate the people that he needed to motivate. He kind of had a positive track, but he also had, and they talked about this during the campaign, a voter suppression track where they were using dark posts, essentially posts that are not available publicly anywhere to this day, target minority voters with messages about Hillary Clinton that they knew would demotivate them from turning out. And, you know, was able to leverage a relatively small amount of money effectively. You know, you don't really ever know why someone goes to vote or why they don't vote. It's probably a lot of factors, and the weather is, I'm sure, involved, and all sorts of other things are involved. But look, he was able to thread the needle and get votes right where he needed them and depress votes right where they needed them. And so you would have to say, well, maybe this strategy did have an impact. And I think it probably did.
So it's hard to think about where we go from here and what the role of the media in the Trump era is going to be without also confronting the new X factor of fake news. And this has received a lot of attention in the past several weeks, maybe a month. But the sort of the cycling of so-called news that is actually mass produced, really a cottage industry that sprung up to produce it, but that just none of it's actually true. That it in many cases relies on Facebook or other social media infrastructures to reach people in an era where fake news in many cases actually drowns out or is more persuasive or more heavily consumed by voters, by the American public than real news. What is, in your view, the role of the media in this moment that we're living in and heading into the new administration?
Well, I think that fake news is a complicated issue. I think that there's a number of different things going on. There's people who are just producing news that isn't true because they want to make money. And they would write about whatever they needed to write about to make money. There's certainly a lot of that, and a lot of it was pro-Trump because that's what worked for them. There's people that are essentially writing propaganda that they know isn't true, and they're using it to try to move voters. That's a whole nother category. There's also people who are trying to write things that are true but are just bad at their jobs and so end up writing things that are false. And then there's other people who are writing things that are based on truth but then kind of spinning them so much that they turn into a falsehood. So there's a lot of different factors that I think are getting conflated under fake news, but I think that there are no shortcuts, that ultimately you need to try to be an educated consumer. And one of the things that Facebook has done has reduced the power of branding. It kind of equalizes every single website and makes it all seem the same. And it's going to be difficult to sort of overcome that. I don't know what to do other than to try to make compelling content that's true and get it to as many people as you can and sort of fight against it that way. But maybe there's something smarter that can be done. It's certainly something I'm thinking about, but I don't necessarily have an answer.
Well, is part of it, and you're the yeah. news person, not me per se, but it is part of it that it's actually incumbent on traditional media to find other delivery mechanisms beyond just hoping that people are going to come to your website or maybe click on a tweet that you've sent out?
I think that's part of it. I mean, I think that's part of it. I think for news consumers, I would encourage them to also just go to sites that they know and trust. One of the big problems is people become reliant on like a Facebook as an intermediary, and then you're reliant on their algorithm, and you could be exposed to things. Whereas if you go to, you know, Think Progress or another site, you get essentially a curated selection of things that we believe are true and important. And, you know, same thing at the Washington Post or wherever else you would want to go. So I think that's one thing a news consumer can do. I do think, yes, kind of cultivating a more loyal audience somehow would be a great idea. It's just there's large kind of huge trends that are happening as far as how people are consuming information that might be difficult to fight against. So we'll have to kind of see how that plays out.
In the wake of the election, Think Progress announced that you would be expending a great and heightened share of your resources in reporting to accountability, to investigation. How is that going to play into the work that you guys do, and how is that going to shape your coverage in the next 4 years?
Well, I think it is an overwhelming task. I remind myself that we're not going to be able to do everything. Hopefully, we can do a couple of things really well. But I think it will be, you know, probably for the next 4 years at least, a huge part of what we do. It kind of goes back to our roots. When we played an accountability role in the Bush administration, I think we played an accountability role in the Obama administration as well. But as a progressive organization, it was different because it wasn't necessarily an administration that was so hostile to everything that kind of motivates the coverage that a progressive media outlet is interested in. Yeah, I think it's going to change a lot. I think it's going to require more digging. I think there's going to be less access, not just for us, but sort of all around. And it's going to require a certain bit of fearlessness, because one of the things with the hacking and everything else is that, you know, people, you can be targeted and you can be become the center of the story. And I think that's something everyone's aware of, that there's a lot of scrutiny on this kind of work. And so it's going to kind of, we're all going to have to sort of buck up and get ready to fight.
Well, and in the last 30 seconds or so that I have with you, the sort of simultaneous million-dollar question that I feel is getting asked and really is litigated in the press right now is, do we as progressives and do progressive media right now need to turn to normalizing Trump rather than following the sideshow, or is resistance the right tack?
Yeah, I would avoid normalizing Trump. I think that some of it kind of happens because people – it's hard to kind of grapple with everything that's happening. And so I think it's easy to say that this is going to be okay and that it's all going to work out. I think it's also easier to say if you're coming from a position of privilege. I think that it's setting up pretty well for white guys like myself, and we're not going to be under attack as much as a lot of other people. But I think we need to be clear-eyed about the fact that this is very abnormal and it's very extreme, and we need to understand that there is no precedent for this, and we can't expect to be able to predict it, and we've got to really take it on. So I would say no to normalization and yes to resistance and vigilance and accountability.
Judd Legum is the founder and editor-in-chief of Think Progress. Judd, thanks so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio, and
thanks.
You've got
this
your work
great.
Cut out for you.
I do.
And that's the show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. You can find us anytime at www.talkpoverty.org/podcast, where we have a full archive of all past shows. You can also listen to us anytime as a podcast on iTunes. And send us your pitches to info@talkpoverty.org. Thanks for listening.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working trying to bring in the dough. And underdogs could connect me with the HMO. And nowadays it's common for grandparents to outlive their grandkids. And those are the type of odds that we handling. I'm not a slave to a man with a whip. I'm a slave to the U.S. men. And they got me doing things in my life that never made any sense. But it paid me in dollars and cents. I need the money for the food, the health care, the schools, and bus fare.